That's a wonderful song. When you think about it, who are we? We're nothing but wretched sinners. Every one of us deserve hell. If you don't think that you deserve hell, you don't know what salvation's about. We're all sinners, and sin brings forth death. And death is a separation from God. But because of the love of God, the mercy of God, the grace of God, we're sinners, but thank the Lord, now we're saints. And so that's a beautiful, beautiful song. Thank you, Trace. I appreciate that. Well, I call your attention tonight to 2 Samuel 18. The last time we were here was 2 weeks ago. Last week was when I got scared a little bit. I've calmed down during the week. Some of you don't know what I'm talking about. Maybe you weren't here. But we had a missionary that broke out in an Ethiopian dialect, and I thought that joker started speaking in tongues. And I was fixing to have to rebuke him because I point blank asked him that before we ever agreed to let him come and share. So anyway, it's been 2 weeks ago since we were in Samuel. And tonight we're going to look at 8 verses. The title of the message tonight is Pits, Ravines, and Wild Animals. Pits, Ravines, and Wild Animals. If we were to look back at the end of chapter 17, we would see that David has been resupplied. You know, he had left Jerusalem quickly. He was just basically trying to get out of Dodge as fast as he could possibly go. He had some people that were with him. They crossed the Kidron Valley. They went right across that little creek that they call the Kidron. And then he went up to the top of the Mount of Olives, and then they crossed on over, and he had hundreds of people. Well, it seems as though that since he has now come to this fortress that is down below the Dead Sea, a place called Mahanaim, you have David, and it seems as though more people have begun to come to where he is at. We will see some of those in a little bit as we go over our passage tonight. But last week we had three representatives that came. They came from different groups. There's some people think that these were dignitaries that were in an official capacity. That may very well be. But you had one man named Shobi, you had one named Machir, and you had one name, and I think it's pronounced Barzillai. And so you've got these three men, and each one of them brought different things. You can see in verse 28 what they brought, 29 also. They brought beds, they brought basins. They brought earthen vessels. In other words, they were bringing things that they could prepare meals in. They brought beds so that there would be at least some type of little pallet that they could lay out on. They brought wheat and barley and flour. They brought parched corn. They brought beans and lentils. No doubt these were dried beans and dried lentils. And they brought parched pulse, which is probably seeds. You know, sometimes we have folks today and they go, well, you know, man, that's kind of a unique thing, all these baseball players chewing sunflower seeds. Well, people have been doing that for millennia. And so you've got the seeds that they were eating. They have honey, they have butter, they have sheep, they have cheese of the milk cows. And they do this for David and for the people. And so they have been resupplied. Now it's time for a fight. And so we begin chapter 18 tonight, and I want you to remember the numbers. I've already shared this with you on one occasion. Absalom has all the nation of Israel that basically have accumulated themselves to him. He has gone from the northern part to the southern part, and he's had these tribes, and they have kind of coalesced around him, with the exception of just a few, but the leaders of these tribes are with Absalom. We'll see tonight that he's probably got an army of over 20,000. David, how many does he have? Well, he doesn't have that many. When we begin to look at the numbers that most scholars think, they think that David is outnumbered anywhere from 3-1 to 7-1. If he is outnumbered that much, he could have had as few people as 4,000. He could have had as many as 7, but nobody thinks more than 7. And so you've got 20 plus thousand against 7 if you take the big number. That's still 3-1. If you take 4,000, that's a little over 5-1. And so you've got David, and he is outnumbered. He may be outnumbered, but just remember a couple of things. He's smarter than Absalom, and he's got God on his side. Keep those two things in mind, all right? There are some people, and they think because of the overwhelming numbers that they have, they're just going to just roll right over, you know, the opposition. I remember when I was in high school. My 10th grade year was 1972. We had a baseball team, and we were on a trip to Albany, Georgia. We only went through the 10th grade, our little small Christian school. And we were going to play this huge school in Albany. And they had a left-handed pitcher that all we heard was that the Braves are already looking at him. That's how good this lefty was. And here we are, we're 10th graders, we're 9th graders, and a few 8th graders. And we roll into Albany, and we began the first night, which was like a Friday night, and we had a game. We beat them on Friday night. Now, we're talking about a team with mainly juniors and seniors, and here we are, we're sophomores and freshmen, and at that time, junior high. But we squeaked out a win. But the next day is when their big gun was going to be pitching. Saturday. So Saturday morning, we're back at the ball field, ready to play the second of two games on this Friday-Saturday schedule. Do you know that this little ragtag group of people that had 10th graders and 9th graders and 8th graders, we beat that guy that supposedly the Braves were looking at? Now, we didn't hammer him bad, but we beat him. And do you know that at the end of that, only thing I'm thinking is, that must have been God. Now, I later have learned that I don't know that God really cares a whole lot about athletics. You know, the old saying was about the Dallas Cowboys when they built that stadium with the open roof so that God could watch his football team. Well, I don't know that the Lord cares a whole lot about football, basketball, baseball, wrestling, or anything. But you have the Lord in this situation tonight. You've got David, and David knows that he is God's man. And so I want us to look at just three quick things this evening. I want you to look beginning in verse 1, and we'll go down through probably verse 4, and I want you to see David's divisions, right? I could also have entitled it David's discernments, all right? But I call it David's divisions because that is what we see in chapter 18, verse 1. And David numbered the people that were with him. Now, the word numbered there is a Hebrew word. It has the idea he mustered them together. Whenever you have a muster, you're calling them together. And what does he do? Well, he sees how many he has. And he says that he set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. In other words, as he began to go through and he began to look at these numbers and he's mustered these men together, he said, okay, you'll have 100. You'll have 100. Now you'll have 1,000. You'll have 1,000. And he begins to divide up the army. He has three heads that are going to each take a third, and then they have those other captains that have the hundreds under them. And so I don't know if they were divided equally. I don't know. The Bible does not tell us any of that. But it does tell us that David sent forth a third part of the people under the hand of Joab. Now, Joab is a soldier. When you find Joab, you find a man that took his military career very, very serious. He has been a he's been special for a long time when it comes to the ability to fight. You remember when they took Jerusalem back when the Jebusites had it? Joab was the first one up the water shaft, and so you've got Joab who has the first third. Then, under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zariah, Joab's brother, and so you've got a second third that is Abishai's. He was like the second guy up the water shaft. So all of this has to do with ability. You're not getting promoted in David's army because of nepotism. You're getting promoted because you have succeeded. You have had victories. You are the best of the best. It's a little disconcerting when I hear some of these newscasts today where you have military that are giving, or not giving it, but basically reducing the requirements for fighting troops in the military. And they're talking about women that are pregnant having special uniforms. And I'm thinking, what, have we lost our mind that we're sending a pregnant woman to fight? But yeah, we've lost our minds. We literally, in this country, we have lost our minds. We have people that are in charge of various things, and some of the decisions they make are absolutely nuts. And yet, they think that they're the brightest people around. And yet, you've got these men as old as 3,000 years ago, and how did David promote them? By achievement. It was not because of gender. It was not because of anything except that they excelled. And can I tell you, that's the way it ought to be? If you're going to have a military, which is mainly to break things and kill people, you want somebody that's good at it. You don't. Let me just tell you this. My dad was a cop, and I'm chasing this rabbit. I got to get back to my message. My dad was a cop. And all I'm thinking is this. If I'm in trouble and I need a policeman, I don't want you to send a 5'1", 110-pound woman to save me. I want you to send a 6'5", 240-pound hunk that can knock you out with either hand or could shoot a gnat off of a guide wire at 50 yards. I want somebody that's tough. You say, well, she might have a gun. Yeah, well, he might take it from her. I want to have somebody that can do the job. If I'm in a fire, I don't exactly meet the standard that my doctor wants me to meet. According to his weight chart, I ought to be about 6'9". All right? Well, I'm not 6'9". It's more like 5'9". All right? If I'm in a fire and I'm incapacitated, send somebody that can at least drag me out. I don't want somebody to go, he should have lost some weight. Too bad, he got to stay. But I don't want to stay. I want you to drag me out. Send somebody that can do it. There's achievement going on here with Joab and Abishai. And then there's a third man that is listed as well. And he is a man that is highly thought of. And who is he? It's Ittai. He is a Gittite. He's not even a regular Israelite. But yet, in David's army, he has now gone up through the ranks to the place where he is probably like the third If the three commanders were talking to each other, he'd probably be the third, and there's a lot of people that are under him. And so we see the divisions. And what does David do? He divides his army. He has mustered them. He has numbered them. And so he divided his army into three groups. Do you know that that is really kind of a very common thing in the Bible? Did you know that Gideon did that? Gideon divided his army with the lanterns and with the pitchers and with the shofars into three groups. And so, why is that? Well, when you're outnumbered 5-1, do you just want to get out on an open field and just go at them? That means that every one of yours has got to kill five of them if you're going to survive. And so David, he knows strategy. He knows that he's outnumbered. And so what does he do? He begins to prepare how to attack. He knows where to attack. And David has set this up in the direction that he has gone. He has set this battle up not to take place in like a huge wide open field like the Battle of Armageddon is going to be fought in. But it's going to be fought in a place called the Wood of Ephraim. And we'll get to that in just a few minutes. And so we see that he is divided. Not only does he divide his group up in his plan, but he said this at the latter part of verse 2, "I will surely go forth with you myself also." Do you know that he learned his lesson about that? He learned his lesson well. You say, "Well, preacher, what do you mean by that?" If you go back to 2 Samuel chapter 11, that's been many moons ago in our series. But you go back to chapter 11, and what do you find? The Bible says that it was the times when kings go forth to battle. But Joab tarried in Jerusalem. In other words, the springtime had come. The rainy season had stopped. And it was the time when those kings were going to fight and see who was the toughest. And David sends Joab, and so that evening, when he's supposed to be fighting, he's walking around on his porch, and he's looking down on his officers' quarters. And what does he see? He sees Bathsheba. All of that happened because he was not where he was supposed to be. And so if you go back to chapter 11, I think that David probably has learned his lesson about maybe trying to be where you're supposed to be. And so he's got a renewed energy. He is he's excited about leading his troops again. I mean, he's probably thinking about the glory days, how that when Saul was chasing him, and how that he would be able to hide in the darkness, and how he was stealth, and he could just basically outmaneuver anything that Saul threw at him. And he's feeling those old juices again. And he says, "I will surely go forth with you." But notice what they say. They say, "Thou shalt not go forth. For if we flee away, they will not care for us. Neither if half of us die, will they care for us. But now thou art worth 10,000 of us." I really believe that the word 10,000 there, I believe that is a figure of speech. I don't think that there were 10,000 people that he had at this time. I think that he probably, maybe, if you count kids and women, maybe 10,000. But when you're talking about men, not so. And so you've got these men and they're making a statement. That'd be like saying to your child, "I've told you a million times." Now, you really haven't told them a million times. It's a figure of speech. And I think that's what we have here in our passage. In other words, you're more important than we are. And so he is talked out of going because of his importance. Does anybody in here know the name Shelby Foote? Anybody? Okay. But tell you who Shelby Foote is. Shelby Foote is the man that narrated the Civil War on PBS. He's a Southern guy. He's got that Southern drawl. He speaks real slow. Well, he's written probably the definitive book on the Civil War. And so he tells the story, and this is the way that the story goes. March the 6th, 1864, the Southern troops have had their lines breached by the Northern troops. Now, the cannoneers are still able to fire their guns, and it's kind of holding them back at bay. Robert E. Lee is on the scene himself. And he's looking at the battlefield and the layout, and he's seeing that they have breached the line, but yet the cannoneers are able to put their armaments in these cannons, and they're firing. But he knows that ultimately, unless reinforcements come, they're going to lose. And all of a sudden, somebody calls his attention, and he looks, and he sees a brigade of Texans that are coming. And he gets so excited that he jumps on Traveler, which is his horse, and he says, "I'm going to lead the countercharge." And his troops just stop. They won't go anywhere. And then all of a sudden they begin to say, "Lee to the rear. Lee to the rear. Lee to the rear." And what they were saying is, "You are more valuable than we are. You are more important than we are. You need to go to the back and let us do the charge." And Shelby Foote tells that story in that book on the Civil War. That's exactly what David's men are telling him. They don't care if they kill half of us as long as they get you. It wouldn't matter to them if half of us died, as long as they get you. And then they go on to tell him, they said, "Look, there's going to be a few people that are left at the city, at Mahanaim. And you're going to be able to bring supplies and reinforcements if needed." Look with me at the latter part of verse number 3. "But now thou art worth 10,000 of us, therefore now it is better that thou succor us out of the city." In other words, you bring reinforcements from the city if the battle goes against us. And so the king says to them, "What seemeth you best, I will do." That brings us to the second thing tonight. And I'm calling this David's deficiency. David's deficiency. Look with me at the latter part of verse 4. "And the king stood by the gate. All the people came out by hundreds and by thousands." When I see all the people, I'm thinking that that's all the military men. "And the king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, Deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom." I want you to get the picture. Everybody goes in and out of the gate. David is standing by the gatepost. And as the men are walking by, he's nodding. He's smiling. "You can do it, guys. You can do it. You can do it." But when three men lead their division by, when Joab comes by, David says, "Joab, deal gently with the young man." And Joab hears it. And everybody around Joab hears it. And old Joab just kind of looks at David and just keeps riding. Abishai, he brings his division by. Abishai, deal gently with the young man for my sake. And Abishai just kind of looks. He's probably thinking, I know what my brother's thinking. I'm not doing that. And then all of a sudden, the third division comes by, and that's Attai. Attai, you're a good soldier. You're a leader now. Deal gently with the young man for my sake. And so probably of the three, and I'm reading between the lines here, Attai is probably the only one that probably says, yes, sir. And so we look and we see that they're walking out. And now, what does this deficiency stem from? Well, in my mind, I think that David probably has blind spots. I think I've probably used that term before. David had blind spots probably more in his family than at any other, I guess, area of his life. He did not discipline his children. It seems as though that his boys just kind of ran roughshod over whatever their father said. And because he did not deal with this early, now he's having to fight one of his own boys late. Now remember, David is no spring chicken any longer. He's been on the throne a good while. I mean, he's probably been on the throne over 20 years by now. And so you've got this young man, Absalom, David's own flesh and blood. And he hates his father and wants his father's position so much that he literally would kill him if he had the chance. What has Absalom ever done that really got any discipline from David? Not much. Oh yeah, he got shipped off, you know, for a year or so, you know, and he was not able to see the king's face. That's almost like going off to college and not seeing your parents' face. Then you come home, oh, it's good to see you. Wash my clothes. And you've got David that just dotes. When Absalom kills his brother that had raped his half-sister. First of all, David didn't deal with Amnon, who raped Tamar. Then Absalom says, well, Dad's not going to deal with it. I'll deal with it. So he kills him. And instead of David executing him because he had committed a capital murder, what did he do? He sent him off into exile for a year. But now, all of that, because it was never dealt with, there's going to be a battle, and there's going to be upwards of 20,000 people just on one side that's going to die. And so, we have David and his deficiencies. And it's a sad thing when a child wants a parent to die when that parent loves that child dearly. I read a sad, sad story early this morning. It was actually not a story as much as it was a lady that was just bearing her soul about her child. She had always been, I guess the term in the groups that I hang out with, I guess she had always been very left-leaning, right? One of the words today would be woke. And she had always loved this boy, her son. But she had raised him in a way where that there were no absolutes, you know. And so he decided that he was going to transition. And because the mom was like, well, I don't really think you ought to do that. He has cut her off. And she You could just read in the article the hurt, the pain. She said, I love my son. I want to support my son. But yet, because he knows how I feel, he has absolutely nothing to do with me. And all I could think about was the heartache that that woman must be going through. I mean, even if you have a son or a daughter that's rebellious, you know, if they at least have respect a little bit for you and what you believe, then that's okay. But to just cut somebody off, that's a horrible thing. What about grandparents that get cut off? What about aunts and uncles? And they just, relationship severed. That's how Absalom felt. He hated his father. But even with David being a recipient of hatred, he still loved that boy when he says, Joab, deal gently with my boy. Abishai, deal gently with my boy. Attai, deal gently with my boy. What's the lesson that we need to learn? Well, we need to learn to discipline our children if we have small kids. We need to make sure that even as grandparents, we don't let any and everything slide. We make sure that we're trying to direct in a right way. But David had a blind spot in that area, and the truth of the matter is we all have blind spots. I think that probably I have blind spots probably in my family. And I'm telling you, that's something that we ought to pray about, and I pray about it often. And so we see that there is David's divisions. We see that David has some deficiencies. But let me give you a third thing tonight, and we'll be done. I want you to look at Absalom's defeat. Let's pick up the passage in verse 6. So the people went out into the field against Israel. And again, where they're battling is not a huge wide open field. It's simply an open area, and that's the direction they're going. You remember, Absalom's got 20,000, and you've got David, and he's got at the most 7. And so he's got them in 3 divisions. He's got one that's going to flank them this way, one's going to flank them this way, and then one that's probably going to start the whole fray where that Absalom's people go, there they are, let's go get them. And the next thing you know, they've got people coming in from the sides. And so it says that the battle was in the wood of Ephraim. Now, if you look at the nation of Israel, you will find that this battle took place on the western side of the Jordan River. The country of Ephraim was on the eastern side of the Jordan River. But the wood, the forest that was on that west side, it was named the Wood of Ephraim. And you had people of Gilead, these mountain men, these guys that were used to this terrain. What did they do? They came to David and said, we're with you. Now, why was that important? Well, David had chosen the battlefield. He was realizing that he's outnumbered quite significantly. But if he can fight on his terms, he can help even the odds. And so that's what we've got, is we've got David, and now he is in the forest of Ephraim. Now, what is this forest like? Well, according to most people, they talk about it being a place of deep ravines. There are pits. There are people, when they get injured, the wild animals attack and kill them. You've got oak trees that have limbs going in all types of directions. And all I can think about was those movies that I saw when I was a little boy and the trees coming to life and moving their arms and all of this stuff. When you're thinking about the woods of Ephraim. In other words, that's a place where you don't want to be when the sun goes down. And so, that's where the battle is going to take place. David chooses this battlefield and he maneuvers Absalom into coming to fight there instead of in the wide open spaces. And so, we read on. Look at verse 7. Where the people of Israel were slain before the servants of David. In other words, you've got all of those people of Israel, all of those soldiers that followed Absalom, they're called the people of Israel. And it says, they were slain before the servants of David. David's got a lot of people in his group that's not even Israelite. And so, it says there was a great slaughter that day of 20,000 men. 20,000 men. When you look at verse number 7, what do you see? You see Absalom's troops and they are fading fast. Can you just imagine? Here they are, they're looking at that oncoming division and they're thinking, yeah, we outnumber those guys. And then all of a sudden you've got these guys coming in from the side, maybe Abishai from one side, Attai from the other side, and then all of a sudden Joab from the middle, he begins to charge. And these guys are now basically encircled except for retreat going backward. And so they're dying. They're beginning to be discomfited. They're being scattered. And that's a word that we'll see here in a second. And so they are going down quickly. And 20,000 men die in just a short time. I mean, it's not even a day. And so, when you read that, when you think about things like that, does that verse that's in Ecclesiastes ever come to your mind? The race is not always to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. I think that's Ecclesiastes 9:11. God had David win this battle, and I really believe that the reason is because David is still the king. Does not matter what Absalom in the world does, David is still the king. I don't care that Absalom went to Jerusalem, took over the palace, slept with David's concubines, and did that in front of all those people with all those flags on top of that palace. I don't care about that. God set David on the throne to be the king, and he's still the king, not Absalom. And so, God is going to make sure that his plan comes to pass. Now let me share one final word with you from verse number 8. And the battle was there scattered over the face of all the country. The word scattered has the idea of dissolving, dissolution. So you've got all of Absalom's army and they are all together. They're come at from three different directions. They are discomfited. They begin to dissolve. Why? Because they're dropping right and left from the swords and from the spears and from whatever other type of weapons David and his men had. And so they are scattered over the face of all the country. That means that they are running into the woods of Ephraim. They're running into that forest trying to get away, but that's where they have been being killed. Every time they get around a tree, there you go, somebody's just got stabbed. Next thing you know, somebody's jumping off of a tree limb and stabbing them in the back. And that number that was 5-1, 7-1, 3-1, whatever it was, that number went to defeat, no matter that a majority was on Absalom's side. But one of the interesting things about this last verse that we'll look at tonight is what the latter part of it says. It says, "And the wood, the forest, devoured, caused the death of," if you want to use that phrase, "more people that day than the sword devoured." Now let that sink in for a moment. The forest killed more than David's soldiers did. Does that not sound like something that God would allow to happen? God can take unusual circumstances and bring victory to those circumstances. He can take circumstances when we are outnumbered, and he can give us victory. He did it in this particular case by using a ravine or several ravines, by using pits, bogs, oak tree limbs, all of those things where that when those men were running, next thing you know, they run this way and off into a ravine they go, and they break a leg. Another one runs and he's looking over his shoulder as he's being chased, and then all of a sudden he runs right into a sharp limb. And all those that maybe were injured and they had not yet died from falling into a bog or falling into one of those ravines or into one of those pits, they're there and they're bleeding, and the night begins to fall. And the wild animals begin to come out. And the next thing you know, you hear the screams in the forest. And you've got wild animals that are feeding on the carcasses and the bodies of living people. And the forest devoured more than David's men killed with the sword. You know what that means? Of the 20,000 people that died from Israel that day, over 10,000 were killed by the forest. That's a lot of dead people laying in the woods, folks. That's a lot of dead people. Next time, we're going to look at Absalom. We're going to see Absalom, and he is trying to flee. But yet, he's going to meet his end. David is going to be disobeyed. And he's going to be disobeyed by Joab. And when you disobey the king, you could die, but Joab's not going to die. And I'll give you the reason why I think that next time. Let's stand together. Appreciate